First of all, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you all for coming, and it's a beautiful day outside, so I appreciate your participation here. The way I think about the Middle East, and I will put the Arab Spring in context, is that, like Europe, for much of the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, at least until the end of World War II. The Middle East, the broader Middle East, the Islamic part of the Middle East, is dysfunctional. It is a region that's not working. It's not working for itself, and it is also the source of many of the most important geopolitical problems, security threats, that the world faces. And as Europe in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century, its problems were the problems of the world until after World War II, when it began to organize itself in ways that produced both peace and prosperity for it. And it took a very long, protracted period of time, even world wars, for it to settle down, so to speak. The center of gravity of dysfunctionality of challenges globally has shifted southward to this region, to the broader Middle East. And the reason for the dysfunctionality has to do in part with domestic systems that are not producing for the people. It has to do with numerous regional problems, rivalries, territorial disputes, some of which has to do with the colonial history of the region. Some of it has to do with dynastic rivalries, family blood feuds, if you like. Some of which has to do with the crisis of civilization of the Islamic world. At one time, many Muslims feel that they were doing very well. They were indeed perhaps dominant. They were a center of education. Universities existed over 1,000 years ago in places like Iraq or Egypt. And then they've declined. And they asked themselves the question as to what went wrong and what should they do about it. And that decline and that questioning has produced a variety of responses from those who say that the reason for the decline is that the Muslims abandoned true faith, and only by going back to the true faith can they achieve greatness again. To those who believe that you have to imitate those who are great now, and therefore you have to copy, adapt what successful countries are doing, that they are generally secular, they are follow a particular economic model and what have you. So for some time to come, I think the future of this region and how it evolves to become a more functioning region is going to be a focus of not only local leaders and political forces, but also, since it impacts the world, also of the international players. Now, the Arab democracy movement, which although everyone looking at the region knew that this region was not working, but the movements that have come about in the last year or so has come as a surprise, especially that it has come in so many places, so closely in time associated with each other. There is a hope that it will deal with one of the sources of dysfunctionality, which is the lack of freedom, lack of economic opportunity, lack of democracy in the region. And while the potential is there for this positive evolution to take place, but in these struggles, in these changes, there is great uncertainty. It's one thing to overthrow, and civil society organizations play a big role. It's another thing to establish a democratic order, which requires fewer actors, political parties, a national compact about what you want to do, where do you want to go, and then the capability to implement it. And I'm not sure. I think there will be some positive things coming out of this, I have no doubt. But there, I also worry that some negative things will come out as well, the democratic forces or the civil society groups that play the role in the overthrow or will play a role in some other overthrows that, in my view, will also happen. The civil society groups are not that good in the next stage, which is how they organize a polity. For example, you see many of the Egyptians who were instrumental in the overthrow. Some of them are signing book contracts in New York and traveling across the U.S. to talk about what they did and how they did it, while the Islamic Brotherhood, for example, is much better in organizing itself to prepare for the election. And we are, as a country, just I will stop with that, very good at our system, helps with civil society. We have organizations that, like the National Endowment for Democracy that I'm on the board of, that assist civil society organizations. But we're not that good at then encouraging political parties and having support the right forces in elections. So when asked to be cautious in one's optimism that everything will turn out positive, or even most things will turn positive, I think we will see some positive and some negative. It is part of the broader transformation that the region that has to go through will go through. And we will all have to do what we can to assist. But our ability to shape it is rather limited.
Well, that I think that rightly takes us back to when you first arrived in Afghanistan weeks after the war as the special envoy from the president, and then eventually appointed to ambassador. The Taliban was removed, and there was a political void. You were given the responsibility to look beyond the military outcome and to look at the kind of political institution building and creation of civil society, and we're still in that process today, obviously. But if you could look back upon those early days when you first got there, no constitution, institutions really in their embryonic form, what did it look like for you? What were the challenges? What were you asked to do by our national leadership?
Well, after the overthrow of the Taliban, and you remember that, maybe some of you don't remember, that it ultimately turned out a lot easier to overthrow the Taliban, and we did it with very few forces on the ground. Less than a couple thousand people on the ground, Americans, and mostly with air power and mostly working with locals. The Taliban were routed, although after the first week, the media began to talk about, how come it's taking so long, and we don't know what we're doing and all the rest. But there was the issue of what to do. There were two options. One, to help the Afghans quickly and to set up a government of their own. The other option was to have some kind of international or U.S. Authority running the place for a long time, or for some time, if not for a long time. And the decision was made very quickly that we didn't want to govern Afghanistan, and to work together with the United Nations to convene an Afghan, all-Afghan conference and invite all interested international players to come up with an approach or with an outcome to solving this issue. And of course, it's you have to remember that we believe as Americans that the best way to do it is to let the people choose their system. We didn't designate someone to go and you be the president of Afghanistan. There were the Taliban had been defeated, but they were still hostile and they were resisting. The forces that had helped defeat the Taliban were called the Northern Alliance. But there were also some other forces who had not organized themselves to fight the Taliban, but yet it had substantial support among the population. And you have to take into account also the neighborhood, interested neighboring countries. And so with the UN, it was decided to convene the Northern Alliance for the Pashtuns, who many regarded the Taliban to be ethnically representing the Pashtuns or being strong among the Pashtuns. There was an old man that had been the king of Afghanistan for 30-some plus odd years who lived in Rome. And his supporters were represented, and Mr. Karzai, who became president, was from the, since he lived in Rome, the group was called the Rome Group. The king lived in Rome. And then there were a group, since Pakistan had a lot of interest in Afghanistan, organized in Peshawar, a city on the Afghan border in Pakistan. And then there was a third group called the Cyprus Group, or a fourth group called the Cyprus Group, which had some relations with Iran, but also represented some groups. And Iran, obviously being the other neighboring country, had a substantial interest. And these four groups met in Bonn, Germany. I was not representing the United States. There was Ambassador Dobbins, our representative. This was in December of 2001. The president and Dr. Rice, for whom I worked at that time as the special assistant to the president, asked me if I would also go to Bonn to assist. And there was an agreement. We work closely with the UN. Sometimes the UN can be helpful. It depends on who the envoy is, what the issues are. And so in this instance, the UN was helpful.
You just made a headline.
Yeah. and so we worked closely together, and the Afghans came to an agreement on a government. But then there was a timeline for some of the steps that had to be taken. The initial entity was called the interim government, interim authority, actually, with a chairman. Then there was to be a new constitution the Grand Assembly called the Loya Jirga of the Afghans to have a transitional government and then to have elections. And so when I went to Kabul in January of 2002 and stayed as a presidential envoy for a while, back and forth between Washington and Kabul, one of the things that I had to do to assist with the UN, with others, and with the Afghans for them to get to this national compact, the constitution. One of the big issues that remain, and I'll stop so you can have more questions to ask, and it is an issue that people raise, critics raise, and it's shouldn't we have tried at that time to bring the Taliban also in? Because they had been the government, they got overthrown. Should we have invited them to Bonn and to come? Should we have invited them to the various grand meetings or assemblies that took place in Afghanistan? And the fact was that the Taliban did not want to participate in those events. They thought the overthrow was obviously a very bad idea. They were resisting still. But we came up with the approach that we and the Afghan government and the UN and everyone had was pursue a reconciliation policy as the balance of power shifted against the Taliban, as the new order consolidated, as they accepted the new order, then exchange for acceptance of the new order, participating in the new order, they will get, except for those who had blood on their hand and worked with Al-Qaeda, that they would get an amnesty in exchange. And we're still talking about that, the idea of reconciliation.
Well, by the time you were made ambassador in November of 2003, it was 8 months after the invasion of Iraq. And America's attention had shifted to Iraq and away from Afghanistan. Critics of this shift have argued that this opened the door to a resurgent Taliban. Are the critics right?
No, they're not right, because for two reasons. One, that before I became ambassador in November of 2003, I was simultaneously presidential envoy to both Afghanistan and to the Iraqi, to what was called free Iraqis, these Iraqis who were not supporting Saddam Hussein, the Kurds who were not under the control of Saddam since the Gulf War, Kuwait, other Iraqis who had become emigres. When the president asked me to become ambassador, first I was reluctant for a while to accept to be ambassador to Afghanistan, because I thought, you know, just because I was born there, you know, how is that going to be perceived, and why me, so to speak? I was already had done a lot of back and forth between Iraq and Afghanistan. My family was not entirely happy about me disappearing now for 2-3 years in Afghanistan. So, but nevertheless, he persuaded me to do so. And because he wanted me to go, I asked him that, all right, Mr. President, charm can take you only so far, but I need to have some resources to be able to affect the situation. And and the president gave more resources for reconstruction, actually $1.2 billion. Now, that's not a lot of money given what we're spending now in Afghanistan, which is a surprise to me, how the magnitude of our level of effort now by comparison. But if you see Iraq, our level of effort in Afghanistan before we went to Iraq, with our level of effort after we went to Iraq, there is a significant increase. So one could argue that Afghanistan was the beneficiary of Iraq, because people were saying, why are you making such a big effort in Iraq and so little effort in Afghanistan? And therefore, I think we rebalanced a little bit by increasing, and I had a role myself in it, but that is the case. We spent, if you look at the data, so a lot of, that is the case. Yes, of course, at some level, some of our military assets that were in demand in the initial phase of the Iraq, there were some assets that were transferred from Afghanistan to Iraq. They were more in demand than Iraq. But I think as an overall level of effort, you will see that with Iraq, there was an increase in the level of effort. The reason for the increased insurgency, Afghanistan was initially quite easy. You know, as I said, we had a couple of thousand people. We were welcomed overwhelmingly in Afghanistan. Our approval rating across Afghanistan was over 65%. Our military forces at one time had over 70% approval by the Afghan in the public opinion surveys. I used to tease President Karzai that our soldiers were more popular than he was. And that gave me a lot of leverage when I talked with him and with the Afghan officials. I think the reason for the insurgency, which was largely over time, two factors in my judgment. One was, and hopefully we'll talk about this in more detail, is that our dilemma in dealing with Pakistan, that a sanctuary for the insurgents developed in Pakistan, and an escalation happened by the in terms of support for the insurgents in 2006-2007. And a good question is, why did they escalate? Maybe Iraq had a role in the following way, and that as the situation worsened in Iraq for us, maybe the adversaries thought, the U.S. cannot divert a lot of resources to Afghanistan, so let's escalate here to confront the U.S. with two increased or big sort of potential conflict. So in that sense, there may have been a relationship, but I'm speculating. This is not an informed view that we. I saw a piece of intelligence indicating that the Pakistani intelligence said, let's escalate because they are tied up in Iraq. But the escalation did happen then. And two is that we did not do as well as we might have in terms of institution building in Afghanistan. You have to recognize that Afghanistan started from a very, very low level of capability in terms of a government or in terms of institution. The per capita income of Afghanistan when I got there in January of 2002 was $180. There was no army, no police. We had to take satellite phones with us to give to government officials and international community so they could talk to each other. But yet, our decisive and quick victory raised huge expectations that we are capable of miraculous things. And although a lot has happened in Afghanistan, of course, news coverage is all about negative things because bad news sells. But it's a very different place by comparison. For example, 15.6 million cell phones are now there. I told you I had to take satellite phones from Norway to distribute. And that's a big business itself, the phone industry. Private, it's all private sector. Or only 900,000 kids went to school. Now it's 6 million kids that are going to school, including 35% girls. The girls were not under the Taliban allowed to go to school. Life expectancy. Thousands of children are living now because of what America has done there that would not have lived if you compare it to that time. Per capita income has gone to $600. That's again very little like anything that we have here. But from 180 to 600, that's a dramatic change. But nevertheless, the government has not, institution-wise, has not done well to deliver. Corruption has been a big issue, which I'm sure we'll come to. Rule of law has been limited. And the combination of the insurgency backed by outsiders and some disillusionment that things have not moved as quickly to produce results has brought about the difficulties that we have witnessed in the last couple of years.
Well, let's do corruption first and then Pakistan second, because
yes,
I think that they're both central to the issue, and I suspect to your thinking. On the question of corruption, is it an American problem given where we are today? Is it an Afghani problem? Is it as delegitimizing as, say, the American press would point would report on. How I mean, you know, is it a bar for American companies to come in and do business there? You mentioned over lunch that the Chinese and others are roaring in to Afghanistan, doing projects that Americans could and should be doing.
Corruption is a cancer on the body politic of Afghanistan. It is delegitimizing. And it has to do with several things, in my view. One, it has to do with the availability of a huge amount of money, and it's largely American money. And in part, therefore, it's because of us. And our system of delivering assistance and doing some things has produced this unintended consequence. Of course, we didn't intend this to happen. Sometimes you have one purpose, you do it for that purpose, but it has something else as a consequence. We do a lot of things through contracting our reconstruction effort. We give a contract to someone here, then that company subcontracts it to someone else, and then ultimately it goes to some Afghans. And the Afghans who get the contract, then in order to get things done and to avoid observing some laws and rules, they bribe use, they have the cash to bribe. And there has been a question of should we be a much tighter control or do differently some of the assistance that we provide. That's why, to some extent, when our relations with Karzai has been difficult, we say deal with corruption, and he said, well, you deal with the corruption because your system in part is responsible for the corruption because you have too much money available. We're not, and this is itself is too attractive for officials who make $100 a month salary, and then somebody comes with $5,000 to get something signed. Institutions are weak. People are have lived through 30 years of war. They are very insecure. They don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, so they say that you better take care of the family now. So he sort of takes it $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000, and then when others observe, they say, "Ooh, well, if he's doing it, why shouldn't I do it?" So that's one thing. And second is the culture of corruption exists in that part of the world. They don't look at corruption in the same way that we do, although there is at the same time a lot of complaints about it. So it's not entirely people are accepting of it, but they are not as generally negative as we would like them to be. Second, it also depends on the relationship between us and Karzai. When I was there as ambassador, I have to say that I had hardly any complaints about President Karzai. He was the most charming, the most cooperative, a real patriot who represented this country quite well. Especially when you compare him to Mullah Omar, the cleric what I hadn't seen, this was quite a move forward. But I think particularly in the last several years, our relationship has been quite bad. And I'm not saying that in a partisan way. I don't want anyone to... I'm saying it as an American who worries about our security. And that is that this administration, when it came to power, they regarded Karzai, in my view, also as a Bush appointee kind of thing, as if we had appointed him. So they started looking for others to replace him in the election. They talked a little too much, too publicly, as that they wanted to do this. And Karzai hedged by going to people who would not be susceptible to our influence, bringing him into his fold. And they're mostly warlords and crooks, in my view, sorry. that I had tried before to marginalize, he brought them back into the fold. And at the end, of course, he won the election, and we thought there was a lot of actions in the election that perhaps should not have taken place. And so the relationship deteriorated further because, you shouldn't aim your gun at the king. If you do, you better kill him, or if he survives, you'll remember that for a long time. And it's only until 2 weeks ago that we have a new team, because the team that was in part dealt with these issues wasn't in place until about 2 weeks ago when Ambassador Crocker went to replace him. So that too has had a factor of with U.S. relations worsened. He's gone to folks that have been difficult in this corruption area. So I think that one of the reasons for the continuing insurgency and problems has been this issue of corruption that has not been dealt with successfully.
Well, now let's go to Pakistan. You have described Pakistan as both a friend and an adversary. And in a recent, and I'll read this if you don't mind, in a recent National Interest article, you wrote that the key interlocutor for a deal in Afghanistan is not the Taliban, but Pakistan. And you expanded on this in a New York Times article where you pointed out that Pakistan is the source of many of Afghanistan's current troubles. Among actions you criticized are its role as a safe haven for al-Qaeda leaders, and even a willingness, and I was not aware of this until you wrote of this, and even a willingness to allow factories to exist producing bombs for use against American and Afghani soldiers. Well, 33,000 U.S. troops are set to leave Afghanistan by next summer. What leverage do we have with the Pakistanis and if you could expand a little bit more on, you know, what it is that is driving their interest in Afghanistan, and in a way that that seems so contrary to U.S. interests.
Pakistan is one of the most challenging national security problems that the United States faces. Indeed, the world faces. Our inability, and this goes back to the Bush administration, but also has continued, to come to an understanding with Pakistan on Afghanistan and on the whole issue of extremism has been a huge challenge. On the one hand, we have relied on Pakistan because until recently, some 90% plus of the supplies that the United States forces need in Afghanistan came through Pakistan, Afghanistan being a landlocked country. So therefore, that necessitated that we have a reasonable relationship with Pakistan, a good relationship with Pakistan. Second, there were al-Qaeda leadership that was in Afghanistan. After we went into Afghanistan, they left Afghanistan and went to Pakistan. And Pakistan was important for us to be able to go after al-Qaeda that was there, and therefore we need to have good relations with them to assist and allow us to go against them, against al-Qaeda. And we also have been worried about Pakistan itself, which is a large country, 180 million people, nuclear weapons, over 100 bombs, and producing at a relatively fast pace more weapons and deploying them as a source of concern. Extremism there, nuclear weapons there. That also encourage one to have good relations with Pakistan. And therefore, we provided it with military assistance, with economic assistance, as points of entry for good relations with them. But at the same time, the same Pakistan, for reasons of its own, was tolerating extremists and some of the terrorists on its territory that we were wanted to go after. We wanted them to cooperate with us against. And also allowing the Afghan Taliban and other groups, there are two other groups that are active as insurgents, the Haqqani group, one is called, and the other one, the Hikmatyar group, to recover, organize, train, and go into Afghanistan to fight us and fight the Afghans. So I call Pakistan a country that was relatively unique, being both an adversary and a friend at the same time. And our effort was always to encourage them to become more friend, less adversarial. And we just have not succeeded in doing so. And so one question that comes to mind is, why? Why does Pakistan do this? I have to say that if a Pakistani representative was here, he would or she would say that, no, we're not tolerating the Taliban, Afghan Taliban in Pakistan. No, we are not supporting the Haqqani network. No, we are not supporting the Hikmatyar network. And we are driven by evidence, the U.S. Pakistanis know us very well because we have worked with them extremely closely during the 1980s when we worked together against the Soviets in Afghanistan. So they know how we collect and how we operate, and they protect very well against us because they know us extremely well. And so the evidence initially was very limited. And then we want to know, okay, if there is even evidence, is the president authorizing that? We want to know. Is it the chief of the number one military officer authorizing it? Is it some rogue element that's doing this? I have to say that I myself, from early on, when I was ambassador, suspicious of this. I was constantly raising this issue that we needed to deal with the sanctuary issue. Once or twice, I even got in trouble with my superiors in Washington, saying, you're making our relations with Pakistan difficult by raising this issue constantly. And I was saying at that time that, look, you know, I get very nervous if I see my morning briefing where they think people are coming across the border that is training, and our policy in Washington is not reflecting of how to deal with this issue. But in any case, we ultimately came to a view. It takes us a while, as we are evidence-driven rather than some theory-driven, that yes, there is a sanctuary being developed here for people that are fighting us in Afghanistan. And we have tried to raise the issue many times. President Bush raised it with President Musharraf. He sent me once to talk to President Musharraf, saying, since you know the details, perhaps you can come to some sort of understanding with him. President Bush brought President Karzai and President Musharraf together in Washington a number of times. We created a trilateral group of military people from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the U.S. All of these efforts, and President Obama has continued those efforts. There has been a lot of continuity and perhaps even more attention he paid by appointing a presidential envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Ambassador Holbrooke, to deal with this issue. It hasn't produced the right results, meaning an understanding between Afghanistan and Pakistan, to end the sanctuary. And now our relationship is quite negative with Pakistan, especially in the aftermath of bin Laden's, that he was discovered where he was. The question is, why are they doing this? Why is Pakistan doing this? Is it defensive, legitimate interests, competition with India, fear that India is seeking to dominate Afghanistan to use it against Pakistan, water, border issues? Or is it some imperial design of their own that they would like to dominate Afghanistan as part of a plan to dominate Central Asia because they see themselves in a long-term struggle with India, which is much larger, much richer. And that still is an unresolved issue. But the sanctuary and our inability to deal with it has been a key factor in the insurgency that has continued in Afghanistan. Of course, there is the quickest way to effect it is if there is an understanding can be reached with Pakistan. Because if the sanctuary goes away, it will have a big effect on the state of the insurgency. It won't go away completely, but it will be much less potent. Or to defeat it, the insurgency, and of course that will take a lot of effort and a lot of time, or to come to an understanding with it, which could come out of either the first issue of an understanding with Pakistan, or winning away enough of the insurgents from inside to the government or to the U.S. side, and we have been trying all three over the course of the last 10 years.
Well, you used the phrase effort and time, and it doesn't seem like America has a lot of patience with either of those two things, not only with regard to what is what's happening in Afghanistan, but also Iraq before that and many of our global engagements. If effort and time are not open-ended, how do you see things ending?
Well, I happen to disagree with you a little bit, with due respect. What is that, in my judgment, the American people have a lot of patience and time when they think something is working, it's producing results, and that what we're doing is important. You know, de Tocqueville wrote about democracies, as you know, that they tend to be impatient because there's elections and people are more driven by domestic kind of issues. But if you look at our Cold War period, we stuck with it for a very long period of time. There was the margin difference between Democrats and Republicans. One should do this, one should do that. But we did it. And in the case of both Iraq and Afghanistan, my sense has been that for a while the support was very large. And when the people came to a view that maybe we don't know what we're doing, it's not succeeding, then attitudes change. I think for the current level of effort, there isn't a lot of time left with the $120 billion per year, given our domestic issues and other priorities. But I think still my own view would be that people think terrorism is still a problem. Even with the killing of Osama, it hasn't gone away. It remains, although ideologically it's suffering setbacks. Arab Spring, one positive aspect is that it's an alternative to the kind of extremist Al-Qaeda-style ideology. But the challenge is, and here is where really we need to have a debate, is this level of effort needed for success? What do we mean by success? My own preference is for a much lower level of military effort by us, bigger effort by the Afghans, because they're less expensive. I mean, this is their country, after all. And they're pretty good warriors. So they could... I would reduce our forces significantly over time, put more of an effort into an Afghan force, keep some limited American forces to do counter-terror operations and help the Afghan forces, because we need to, in my judgment, be in the region with some forces, not only because of terrorism of Al-Qaeda, although we could operate from sea or from over the horizon, but that's not as good as being nearby. And two, there are other contingencies that will happen. And you have to take my initial observation of dysfunctional Europe. The world is even much more integrated now. We really can't come home and not worry about some of these issues. And one of which scenario that I do worry about is that Pakistan with extremists there and nuclear weapons, that people worry about the whole country going under extremist control. I don't see that in the current circumstances as a likely scenario, but one or two bombs or pieces of a bomb falling into the wrong hands of terrorists, and we would need to be somewhere where we can quickly go in and deal with the situation. And having some presence in the area would be helpful. And Afghanistan is a country that is willing to accept that sort of presence. And I think there are not many other takers in the area. So I would use our assistance to the Afghans to build up their forces as a way to maintain some counter-terror and military support presence. But I would put much more emphasis on diplomacy, a global initiative with us and others, perhaps a multilateral effort, U.S.-led, and I was hoping that President Obama, with his personal popularity, at least in the initial period around the world, that he would use that popularity in terms of U.S. national interest to get a big effort involving others who also have influence with Pakistan to get an Afghan-Pakistan settlement. I mean, that I think I would say we have put too much burden on the military and not enough of an effort on diplomacy to shape the environment. So I would make those kinds of adjustments, and I think I may be wrong. I'm not an expert on some of our domestic issues. I think such an approach could find sustainable support in the United States.
Well, you've given us a lot. And before we open it up to the audience, let me ask one last gift to our community. Give us the last part of the last chapter of your memoirs. Tell us, as you look back, your time in Iraq, your time in Afghanistan, what goal, what great goal did you have that you're still looking at it and saying it's unfulfilled and here's what we can do to fulfill it? Yeah, I know you've touched upon some of that, but I know that you reflect upon this constantly. And give us some insight. Give us that last chapter in the memoir.
Well, I don't know about the last chapter in the memoir because there's a lot still to be done. But
usually they write them in installments. So
oh,
I think,
well, several memoirs, I don't know. But I would say that in the regard to Iraq, there is an issue of... I mentioned in Afghanistan, we discussed this idea, do we govern them or do we help them govern themselves from early on? In the case of Iraq, there is a question of whether we've made the right choice initially to govern them for a while with Ambassador Bremer to govern Iraq for a period. Did we make the right choice in dissolving the army the way we did? There is some debate, pros and cons. Did we make the right choice in terms of doing them deep debatification? The Ba'ath Party was ruling Iraq, and then we really went for a deep debatification. Did we do the right thing to have the first election when we did, which was we hadn't gotten enough agreement among Iraqis and Sunni Arabs, who had been more dominant before under Saddam, boycotted the election. And then that polarized things, and Al-Qaeda came in and tried to further polarize and create a civil war within Islam between Shia and Sunni by killing innocent Shia, and then they would in turn retaliate. I think there are those questions. Some of these I did not have much to do with because these are the periods that I was in Afghanistan. But when I went to Iraq, when the president asked me to go there, my goal was to help Iraqis as I did in Afghanistan with the Afghans to get them to agree to a constitution that would be a national compact. And we brought the Sunnis in, but I believe that reconciliation still has some time to go. Things have moved in the right direction, I think, evolving, but still has some distance to go for a true reconciliation to take place between Sunnis and Shias. But in the case of Afghanistan, I'm disappointed that we have not been able to work the Pakistan angle. I mean, I tried very hard myself when I was there. As I said, the president asked me to go and talk to President Musharraf. I think that is a big question mark. How to do it remains a big issue. And
does the new team have that recognition?
They do, certainly. They even have it even more than, the new team in Kabul.
Yes.
Well, I think that the team in Kabul, its task is to repair the relationship with President Karzai. That's its primary task. And adjust our military posture. General Allen, who's our military leader there, asked to, we're downsizing the force to do that. I think it's Washington and Ambassador Grossman who replaced Ambassador Holbrooke. It's his job to work, although everybody will have to participate, to work the Afghan-Pak relationship. But you need, maybe even a bigger effort than what we have, involving other countries as well. I would think that although our relationship with Pakistan, our relationship with Afghanistan, and Afghan-Pak relationship is central, but I think we need to bring in some of the other players, the Saudis, the Chinese, and the Russians, the Europeans. We need to go to do a big effort preparing for an international conference to settle the Afghan-Pakistan dispute. I hope that this will happen and happen this year.
Okay. Well, we will now open it up to our audience. This is a question that I'm sure many Americans ask, and I'm sure has been asked of you many times. Please tell us what vital U.S. interests justified going to war in Afghanistan.
Well, terrorism. We had done something with Afghanistan in the 80s. I was involved in that as well as a low-level advisor in the Reagan administration. That's when I started my government service the first time up as a political appointee, going from Columbia University at that time, as an outside advisor. The Soviet had invaded Afghanistan, and there was a concern that this was part of a grand design of moving further south against Pakistan and Iran to get to warm waters, which had been a Russian preoccupation, some people believe, for some time. At the time that we had shown restraint in the revolution in Iran when a pro-American government was overthrown and the Carter administration had shown restraint, didn't go in, didn't encourage in a timely manner a coup against the opposition, didn't support the Shah, some argued strongly. When we showed restraint and perhaps some would argue weakness, the Soviets made a move forward, invading Afghanistan the next door. And a lot of us thought that the Soviets were going to ultimately win in Afghanistan because the neighboring country had gone socialist, there was a one-way street, the Brezhnev Doctrine. Some of you may be old enough to remember some of this. Therefore, we thought how to make the consumption of Afghanistan costly for the Soviets so they would learn a lesson and not do it again. Lo and behold, we did better than that. The Soviets were defeated. They were forced to withdraw. That not many people anticipated that would happen. That in turn may have contributed to the disintegration of the Soviet Union, a great geopolitical success for the United States. But then we forgot about Afghanistan. We achieved our goal, and then the civil war, Al-Qaeda come in, Taliban come in. We abandoned it, so to speak, and 9/11 happens. And so the reason for going to Afghanistan was 9/11. And we obviously have a huge national interest not to allow it to go back to status quo ante, which means Al-Qaeda coming back to Afghanistan. Now, that's the national interest. The question is how you pursue that. And that's a legitimate debate. Do you need to have the kind of strategy and effort that we have now, or could you pursue that interest in some other ways? And I've given you my own sense of how it needs to be adjusted to make it sustainable. But I think even with the killing of bin Laden, terrorism remains an issue. Some other issues have also become important that we talked about, obviously the future of Pakistan, its nuclear weapons, and a presence, some effort in Afghanistan is important in that regard as well.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, it's been about, I think, 35 years since you and I sat in Albert Wohlstetter's living room at the University of Chicago talking about and learning about what will happen in the world. In that time, you've gone out and shaped the world, and you've brought your experience and knowledge to our community, and for that, we thank you very much.
Well, thank you.